This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For most of Cissy Blumberg's life, the July 4th weekend didn't mean fun. It meant the start of the season, time to welcome the guests to Green Acres, her family's hotel in the Catskills. Her father bought the hotel in 1920. She and her husband took it over in the late 40s after his death and sold it in 1975. During most of that period, the Catskill Mountains of New York were the largest resort area in the U.S., with more than 500 hotels plus countless bungalow colonies. Few of the hotels remain. Cissy Blumberg is part of a group trying to revitalize the Catskills as an arts and entertainment center. And she's written a new memoir called Remember the Catskills. Part of what drew vacationers to the Catskills was the big-name entertainment, but the stars performed at the big-name hotels. Blumberg's hotel was small and couldn't afford name talent.
Well, I tell you, we had the big names before they became the big names. I can think offhand of Irwin Corey, who was a busboy at the hotel, Professor Irwin Corey. But we also had what would have been the newcomers. Now the names are established, but in those days they weren't. I would think of Freddie Roman, Alan King, Myron Cohen, Red Buttons. They were names only in the small area in which we existed, and later on went on to become very famous. My brother had tried out a young man named Lenny Bruce and another one named Jackie Mason. But at that time, they were known only to an agent and to a limited number of hotel keepers.
Wait, did your brother try out Jackie Mason and Lenny Bruce and then reject them?
Oh, no. We liked them.
They actually performed at your place.
Oh, yes. I mean, when I say try out, I mean, we booked them. We didn't have time during a season to go looking for them. You know, initially, all of our entertainment started with live-in staffs. Our parents hired an entire staff which took care of the hotel for a whole season. There may have been a comedian and a singer, a soprano, a tenor, and they would bring forth shows which really were remarkably well done. They also couldn't repeat. That's why we became kind of almost a school for entertainers. And we had some very distinguished people who came out of the mountains. Morse Hart, for instance, was at the Flagler Hotel. Dory Shary was there as well and then became the head of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. But we had people like Buddy Hackett, Billy Crystal, Robert Klein, Jerry Lewis, Sid Caesar. These are the caliber of people who came through our stages but were not necessarily stars at the time. We couldn't afford them once they got to be stars. Certainly not the little hotels.
Now, you grew up in your hotel because your parents owned it when you were a child.
Right.
How did your father first come to the Catskills?
My father was a labor leader in New York City. He, as a matter of fact, was the first vice president of the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union. And at that time did a great deal of public speaking and a great deal of work and had his first heart attack when he was about 35. And the doctors advised him that he should find an easier way to live. And believe it or not, he chose a farm hotel in Lake Huntington, New York, to find that, quote, easier life. He came up there in 1920, by the way.
When your father took over the farm hotel, what was the area like?
The area that he settled in, and probably this was true of much of upstate New York in the smaller communities, was extremely restrictive and very resistant to someone of another ethnic group. Lake Huntington, at the time that my father bought there, had a going Ku Klux Klan, a German-American Bund, and they also had a gentleman's agreement not to sell property to Jews.
Which is really interesting, considering the Catskills became famous for Jewish resorts.
Yes, it did. But, you know, one of the things, you know, when you hear Catskills and you think Jewish, the truth of the matter is we were never, at any time, more than 15% of the year-round population. And that pretty much my experience, my parents' experience, was the experience of others who came into the area. Now, eventually, we became a very strong economic factor, but there was tremendous resistance when we first got there.
Your father was the first Jewish hotelman in Lake Huntington. How did he get around their restrictive clause?
I would suspect, number one, he had learned to speak English from phonograph records from London. So he was the only Hungarian I knew who spoke like Winston Churchill, to start with. But in addition to that, he was blue-eyed and dark-haired, I suppose didn't fit the stereotype that people expected. And then again, I think it was that he accepted the first price that they preferred to him. And so one way or another, he became the owner of a restricted boarding house farm in Lake Huntington.
I'd like you to explain why the Catskills were so important to Jewish workers.
Well, I think if you look back at history, you'll discover that there was no place for Jewish workers from New York to vacation. The resorts in the Catskills that preceded the immigrant group were either restricted or very expensive, or both. There's a story in the book, which is a true story, about a family who bought Shawanga Lodge. Now, it was previously owned by a Christian ownership, and in their brochure, there was a note which said very plainly, "No Hebrews accommodated." What was so ironic about this is that the Dan family who purchased it used that brochure, and they took away that item and replaced it with "Kosher cuisine featured." But here were a megalopolis, New York City, and just across the mountain was this area, which they could reach. We had two railroads that went up that way. They were very inexpensive. And they would find their own language spoken, their own customs followed, and in many of the cases, a regimen of food with which they were familiar. So it became a natural. And also, suddenly, the buttonhole maker and the cutter and the taxi driver and the secretary were sought-after guests. This was an area that was looking for them. And they adopted it, and they came there for really almost 70 years. It was a repeat clientele for almost all of the hotels.
My parents took me to the Catskills a few times when I was young, and I loved going there. It was just it smelled so good.
It still does.
And the mountains were so beautiful. And, you know, you were at this hotel, and it was kind of like your job to have pleasure. You know, your parents were always on your case to, like, work hard and do good in school. And so, and here you were on vacation, and it's like you were supposed to have a good time, you know. And so everything was about just enjoying yourself, and it was so much fun to be there. What was it like for you growing up in the Catskills running one of the resort hotels?
Well, when I was growing up, I think that we had an absolutely marvelous time at the hotel. First of all, it wasn't yet a parent-child resort when we were growing up, so we were kind of featured by the staff and the guests and felt very special. I think the other thing was that we were starstruck, and there were already all of these entertainers putting on shows every night so that we would stay and watch them, and we were uncritical and delirious about being with them. Running it, of course, was another story. That was a kind of slavery, and I'm interested in your reaction that you knew that your job was to have fun, and our job was to make you comfortable. And, of course, hospitality was the thing that came through loud and clear. I don't think there was a hotelman, from the largest to the smallest, who wasn't always visible. I wonder if you remember who ran the hotel, for instance, that you may have gone to. There was someone who would greet you by name, who knew what your parents did for a living, who knew how many children there were in the family, which room you had the year before, and what you liked for breakfast. This kind of hospitality, I guess, is a thing of the past, but we were really steeped in it, and it was part of what we did and what we did well.
Now, when you grew up, did you want to take over your parents' hotel?
No. I had no intention of coming back to the hotel, and I was married while I was in college. My husband got out of the army, and we were married and came back and forth and worked at the hotel, but we had no intention of remaining in the business. However, my father, who was ill when he started, was becoming more ill, and when we got out of college, he asked us if we wouldn't stay for a little while. So 30 years is not such a long time, is it?
Did you feel stuck taking it over?
Initially, yes. Initially, I felt, you know, what am I doing among the Philistines, you know, who wants to be a hotel owner? But I will tell you this, it provided a challenge, And little by little, I guess also I'm part of the group that say, bloom where you planted. I had no choice. My father died shortly after that, and there was just no way of our leaving. But I began to like what I was doing. And I, when I relaxed and saw the opportunities, it really was a place to develop whatever kind of talent you had. It was nice to be a star. You know, a hotel owner, regardless of the size of the property, became a star. And there were the entertainment, there was writing the brochures, it was coming up with new ideas for operating, and I must say that all in all, I had a good time at the party.
My guest is Cissy Blumberg. She's written a memoir called Remember the Catskills. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Cissy Blumberg. She's written a memoir called Remember the Catskills about the hotel that her family owned. During the period when a lot of really talented people were blacklisted, you brought some of those people up to the Catskills to perform at your hotel. Tell me how you went about doing that. I mean, how did you know officially who was blacklisted, and how were you able to help them and help yourself by booking them?
It was pretty much in the news who was blacklisted. We didn't look for them individually. Again, it was the agent that you were working with.
Were there agents who specialized in people who were blacklisted?
Not really, but if they had some progressive tendency, they would know who those people were and bring them to you. During the period, we developed an entertainment regimen which we never could have afforded because they were willing to take less and we were willing to give them as much as we could. But we had some very, very interesting, Zero Mostel, Herschel Bernardi, Erwin Khoury, Martha Schlamm. People of this ilk were on our stages. Paul Draper, Larry Adler, Ellie Stone, that was on the stage thing. And then we also had theater groups. That would be Lionel Stander and Phoebe Brand and Howard De Silva, people of that caliber. And then, of course, some lesser lights as well. But the overall tenor of the entertainment took a big jump up when we got those people.
Let's talk a little bit about the dining room that you created when you took it over. I mean, food was such an important part of the Catskills vacation. And all the guests would eat together in a dining room.
Right.
And there'd be several courses for each meal. Even breakfast, there were lots of options.
Many, many courses.
Yeah. So how would you prepare the menu?
Well,
how important was the food, in your opinion, to, you know,
extremely
the,
important.
To the vacation?
I think,
yeah.
Very important. Mm-hmm. I think that people looked forward to it. As a matter of fact, it's one of the things, that I resent, and one of the reasons that I wrote the book was to correct the impression that there was anything vulgar about the amount of food that we served. You know, we're always being compared to other areas. And one of the overriding kinds of things is this great gorging of food, which really wasn't so. It was American plan. It was nicely done. And we did it really with a full heart. You know, food is part of hospitality. Hospitality was the underlying theme for everything we did. Now, menus were created by the ownership along with a whole series of chefs. And we had to do a great deal of improvisation. First of all, because of the availability of foods, and secondly, because people stayed for a long time, so that you couldn't give them a dull menu where every Monday you served exactly the same thing. So there was a great deal of improvising. We discovered that you could have all of the wonderful things that your grandmother made, and then add to that lobster and Chinese food and Italian food, and we had a very wide variety.
So you were not kosher?
No, we weren't. Incidentally, the one other misinformation about our area is that they talk about a hotel as if they were talking about all the hotels. Each of these hotels was family-owned and operated and reflected the personality of the people who were running it. So there really was no cookie-cutter hotel. They were all different. They featured different things. We had many, many things in common, but there was also a personality to each of the places that people attended.
What would you do if a summer was particularly rainy? Because so much of the hotel revolved around outdoor activities, whether it was, calisthenics or swimming or tennis or shuffleboard. These were things that happened outside during the day.
I cried a lot. A rainy day was a disaster. We brought in anything that we could think of to distract them. We had lectures. We had musical groups come in. We had antique dealers demonstrate, flower arrangers, beekeepers, whatever we could think of to distract them. Of course, within a period of time, most of the hotels became a year-round resort and had indoor facilities, the indoor pools and health clubs and that kind of thing for distraction. But rain was a tragedy, whether or not you had the indoor facilities. I remember once a man stood at my desk and he said, "It's raining in your hotel." And I felt so guilty. It took me 10 minutes to realize it was also raining at Grossinger's.
In order to stay competitive, you had to renovate your hotel in the 60s. So in 1963, very expensive renovation. 3 years later, the whole hotel was destroyed by fire. I think lightning struck the main building.
It was 11 bolts of lightning. And
struck 11 times?
11 times.
Gee.
And burnt from the inside out, which made it impossible to put out. We were on top of a hill. And I must say, part of the problem was mine because I had not written the insurance properly. We also didn't have a sprinkler system yet. That was scheduled for the next year. And there was no saving it. The underinsurance, of course, nobody knew that night except I knew it. And I knew that what we were in for, if we were ever going to be solvent again. So that we were able to buy another resort. And it was then in the hands of the bank. We bought the New Roxy Hotel in Locksheldrake, and we renovated it completely, and it became Green Acres, you know, which we affectionately called Green Acres East. And that was a place that already had winterization in it. And I think in the long run made it possible for us to really operate very successfully. But the loss of the first property was a terrible, terrible blow. It was as if your life was burning. All of the economies I thought about as that smoke was going up, you know. Everything was in the hotel. And that was our theory, that we should build our business and that it would take care of us.
God, you must have felt so guilty knowing that you had made the decision to buy less insurance because you couldn't really afford to buy more. And you say you were about $250,000 underinsured when the building burned.
Yeah, it took us 10 years to pay that off, 10 years at hard labor. But we did pay it off, and people were good enough to give us the space to pay it off.
Mm-hmm.
At any point, three creditors could have pushed us into a bankruptcy, but they didn't, and people were very good to us. Not everybody, but a lot of people were very good to us. So we were able to do it, and we were very successful in the new property.
How did you end up selling in 1975?
Well, I think one of the things that happened was that we never, ever put the place on the market because we always thought that we were going to die at our desks and hopefully not on a weekend because we didn't want to spoil anything. But we became an attraction. The mountain hotels, particularly as business receded in other areas, became a very big bargain for people looking for large properties to be used for other purposes. In our case, people came around to look, and I became so annoyed with the looking that I never even got out of my chair. I would just tell them, everything is for sale at a price, and if you wish to look, go look. And one of those committees turned out to be a real buyer. Now, we consulted with our children, who were then in college, who had no desire to follow in our footsteps. And so we happily sold. This is my time off for good behavior.
Mm-hmm. When you sold in 1975, you sold to an owner that turned the hotel into a home for mildly mentally retarded adults.
Right, those with developmental disabilities, yes. And it still is that. And it's an absolutely wonderful, and I won't call it an institution because we've now gone to smaller homes and the whole thrust is toward normalization. I sit on that board, and I'm very proud of what the hotel became.
Well, Sissy Blumberg, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Sissy Blumberg's new memoir is called Remember the Catskills. It's published by Purple Mountain Press. She's also a member of Catskills IDEA, the Institute for Development of Entertainment Arts in the Catskills.